Mitzvah Shin Lamed Zayin 337 Shelo Lahonos B'Mekach U'Memkar. As we mentioned in the laning yesterday, that you're not allowed to cheat others in business. So what here does it specifically mean to cheat or hurt others in business? It's not a generalized prohibition, rather it's talking about something very specific. Shelo Lahonos Echad Mi'Yisrael Bein Zachar Bein Nekeva B'Mekach U'Memkar. Not to hurt anyone else in your business dealings, whether male or female. As long as they're this specific prohibition applies only to Jews, although we know that we're not allowed to cheat and steal, etc., from non-Jews either. But this specific prohibition applies only to Jews. So why does he single out women, males and females? What do you mean? A business prohibition should only apply to males? So well, that makes no sense. How does that do with anything? Because the answer is the lashon of the pasuk is v'chisim karu mimkar la misecha o kano miyada misecha, whether you sell or buy. Al tonu ishe sachiv. It says you shouldn't do ona one man to his brother. So you might think that since it's using the masculine gender when referring to this, it's talking only about males. That's why the Sefer Chinuch has to tell you that this is just a turn of phrase in the Torah and does not specifically mean that it applies only to males, but rather you're not allowed to cheat females either. V'amr zichronim levracha b'sifra. Al tonu ishe sachiv. You shouldn't hurt one person than the other. Zo onas mamon. This is the onah that refers to improper business practices. But there is the other type of onah, which we'll discuss in the next mitzvah, which is the prohibition of onas dvarim, or hurtful speech. Uve gemara amru zichron levracha. The gemara says in Maseches Bava Basra, miyad amisecha davar hanikne miyad liyad. So it says, or maybe you buy from the hand of your friend. So this is talking about something that can be purchased and transferred from one hand to the other. Kilomar mitaltalin. It's talking only about movable objects. It's not talking about vein kavanas amedrash shelo. So not talking about other things. Vein kavanas amedrash shelo yazir akosu v'alanos hakarkos kemokain. It doesn't mean that you're allowed to cheat as much as you want, or charge improper prices as much as you want when you sell land. It doesn't limit the prohibition only to movable objects. El ha'inyan hu lomar shedine ha'ona kigon achilukin sha'amru zichron lebracha. It just means that specific rules about what happens when you do ona. About ona, shehi chozeres biyosu mishtos, as well as the Sefer Chinuch will go in detail later, that the improperly charged price returns to the buyer if it's more than a sixth. Specific things about when the overcharge returns to the buyer and when the whole transaction is canceled. Those specific details apply only to movable objects and not to land and the things that are similar to land in halacha, such as slaves. V'o darshu b'zeakosuv im basaliknos knei miyisrael shnemar o kano miyada misechos. This is an interesting concept, which is that this is not part of the explicit mitzvah, but Chazal learned as a remez, as sort of like included in the mitzvah, that since it says o kano miyada misecha, or you're buying from your friend, don't do onah. So as it says, or you're buying from your friend, so Chazal teach us that when all things being equal, it is better to purchase from a Jewish merchant. That if you have a choice, then you're supposed to patronize Jewish businesses to give, parnasa to our compatriots, our co-religionists.
Also to allow them to, be mekayim this mitzvah of not overcharging you.
Excellent. Yeah. Also, they give. You fulfill a lot of mitzvahs when you conduct business transactions properly. Again, it's important. Somebody asked me this, Shiloh, recently, that he has a choice between buying from a Jewish business or from a non-Jewish business, but the Jewish business was like charging double for the same service. So then it doesn't apply. If the non-Jewish business is much more convenient, or they're charging a much better price, or there's a specific reason that you want to buy from the non-Jewish business, that's fine. It's not telling you that you're only allowed to patronize Jewish businesses. That's certainly not. It's only when all things being equal, if things are about the same, so it's better to purchase from the Jewish business.
Ve'ulai zeh shediktiku b'cha'an lios dinei ha'onah b'metaltel nevad
Lifi Shishana Akosto Beloshon Zeh, the She'amar V'chi Sim Kerumim Kar, that since it says you shouldn't do Ono when you do any sale, Demashva Kol Mem Kar Bein Kar Kabein Metaltel, so first it seems to sound like any sale. And then it specifies afterwards. First it says the general principle, then it specifies a movable object. That there's a, with a movable object, there's a new din. That both are subject to the prohibition of onah, but there's a specific added din by movable objects, which is this whole business about a sixth of the price. But the prohibition fundamentally applies both to land and to movable objects. That we should not intentionally overcharge or underpay. אבל החילוק שביניהן הוא שאם נמצא סונו במטלטל ביסר משטוס שיבטל המחר. That if you overcharge by more than a sixth, then the sale is nullified. שדס הבריאו שלא לספל אונו יסרו מכן במטלטל. And that people are not going to tolerate more than a sixth overcharging when it comes to movable objects. Aval bakarka lefisha karka davar kayim leolam derech abrios limchobo kolona achar shelokhu oso. That if people purchase a piece of land and then they realize they were overcharged, so then they generally are more relaxed about it. They're like, I overpaid by a little bit for my house that I'm going to live in for the next, hopefully, 100 years. Okay, so I'd rather have the house. You know, I don't want the sale to be nullified just because I overpaid a little. Hopefully, real estate will go up. I'll get my money back, etc. So,
not if you live in it for 100 years. You won't sell it. You'll be living in it.
Okay. You can't really put a price on land. Owning land is just amazing and great and. People don't care as much about about the prices. Yeah,
we found out otherwise. Actually,
v'harayu eile kilomar shisro no af bekarka shehari ikar azor azov bekarkos udichsiva k'mosh mefarish v'parsha zodas Ramban zechon avracha ben yezek k'mosh kasu v'erash chomesh. So the Ramban, there's actually a machlokas rishonim that the Sefer Achinuch is going with the opinion of the Ramban, who says, look, this section of the Chumash is basically talking about sales of land. First it's talking about the Yovel, then it's talking about sales of land. So, and this is where it introduces the prohibition of Onah. So clearly the prohibition of Onah applies to selling land. Just these, things about a sixth don't apply. But other Rishonim learned the statement of Chazal literally, that there's no Onah by Karkos, that literally there's no prohibition of Onah at all. That you're allowed to charge whatever price you want for land, and there's no such thing as overcharging for land. As long as the buyer and the seller agree, then this is a the sale is valid. Some say, I think that if you charge double for the land, so then that's that would be constitute onah. But the accepted opinion is like the Sefer Chinuch presents the name of the Ramban that you're not allowed to overcharge for land either. It's just that the sale is not nullified. Shorish haMitzvah Yadua. The reasoning for the prohibition is no ki hu davar shaseichel meyadolav. It's something reasonable. Bimlo nichtav din hushi kasev. Then if it wasn't written in the Torah, so you'd basically figure it out by yourself. Mentioned yesterday about ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. That it's part of the general principle of that you have to do unto others as you have them do unto you, which includes not overcharging. But it was written explicitly in order to create an explicit prohibition out of it.
Now, is it possible for somebody to know that he's been overcharged and agree to it? You know, in other words, can for whatever reason?
Yeah,
you know,
sure. When it says,
"Yeah, nice guy, I'll go ahead, I'll pay him the extra," you know. 30%,
yes,
you know.
When it says that if you overcharge by more than a sixth, the transaction is nullified. It doesn't mean that let's say I charge Mrs. Hirsch $5,000 for my phone. Which is way more than a sixth overcharging. So so Ms. Hirsch now has my phone, and then she goes to the Beis Din to complain. I'm sorry, I go to the Beis Din and I say, you know, this really didn't make sense. You know, forget complaining. The Beis Din finds out. Mm-hmm. There's an Av Beis Din sitting there, and he says, he noticed that I just sold my phone to Mrs. Hirsch for $5,000. So it's not like the Beis Din goes to the Mrs. Hirsch, physically removes the phone, and gives it back to me. He says, you overcharged by more than a sixth, therefore the sale is nullified, and you have to do it again. Because if they said, if Mrs. Hirsch said, you know, I wanna pay $5,000 for this phone, it's worth it to me, and I say, well, I wanted to sell my phone for $5,000, then that's okay, of course. If everyone's mochel, if everybody's happy with what went on, so then there's the sale would not be nullified. Everybody's okay with it. It's not al korcham. It's just if one of them complains, and Mrs. Hirsch now goes to the Beis Din and say, I'm beginning to suspect that this is not the going rate for a cell phone, $5,000. So at that point, then we would have to nullify the sale. Yep.
And you give the money back.
Yeah, sure, of course. So she'ein roi lekachas mamon b'nei odom derech sheker v'tarmis. It's not proper to take money by way of lies and cheating. Everybody should be with their properly, honestly earned monies that God granted them. Everybody has benefit with this. So you cheat at others, so others, you think you can get away with it, maybe the others will cheat you too. So maybe you'll think, well, I can cheat and get away with it. I'm really good at it. Ulai, so I'm not going to suffer because I'm the cheater. So ulai banav lo yukein v'yir mo'osam b'nei adam. Maybe your kids are not going to be as skilled at cheating as you are. So people are going to cheat them. So just because you think you're going to get away with it, ultimately it's going to cause problems with society. It's going to come back to haunt you.
But nimsa shadva, children who cheat.
Okay. No, they're not good at it, he said.
But they'll try. It's not good for your neshama.
Okay. Not good for your neshama, fine. But him says, Shadvarim Shavim Lakol. So everybody's equal in this. B'shehu to'eles rav b'yeshuvah shel olam. That this is really good for society to function. V'ashem baruch hu l'sheves yitzar. That God created the world in order to be inhabited. And the Sefer Chinuch is extending this principle not just to be physically inhabited, but rather inhabited well and successfully and peacefully. So it's interesting that this principle in the drasha yesterday, does not exist by goyim. That you can charge whatever price you want. That's the normal. That's how the market works nowadays. That caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. It's up to the, again, that's not technically maybe what it means in the legal sense, but the idea is that everybody has to be careful they have to be on guard not to be overcharged, and it's not an independent obligation incumbent upon the buyer and the seller to make sure that the price is correct.
Now, by the way, I'm just curious. Do cases like this actually come up before Bati Dinim today?
Sure.
They do? Oh.
Why not? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you could argue that it's harder to fix an exact price nowadays. There is more fluctuation, but in theory, this definitely could come up, yeah. Yep. Midine ha-mitzvah, ma'asha'om zichronam levracha, sha'mocher ve'alkeach shnei ha-muzharim ba'azarezo. You shouldn't think that it's only the seller who's is in charge of fixing the price, so it's only he who is forbidden from doing onash. And emar v'chisim kerumim karla misecha okano. It applies both to buying and selling. Velo yomer alokeach derech ha-mocher ladash shivoyimim karo. V'achar shu mocher li bedamim kalim ein alay avon. So let's say Mrs. Hirsch comes to me and she wants to buy my cell phone. I say, sure, Mrs. Hirsch, I'd like to sell you my cell phone for $10. So Mrs. Hirsch is like, $10? That's a really good price. She's thinking to herself, sure, I'll take it for $10. So she's thinking, what do you mean? He's selling his objects. Up to him to figure out what the correct price is. The fact that he's selling it to me for less than it's worth is irrelevant. That's his problem. So fine, I'll buy the object for $10. So if you know, so he's the Sefer Chinuch is telling us that no, it applies to the borrower as well to make sure that, I mean, not the borrower, the purchaser should make sure that he or she does not underpay for the object as well. It's an independent prohibition. And Ms. Hirsch knows that I'm undercharging for my cell phone. She's required to say, you know, either not buy it or say, no, I don't think that's the right price. So we have to go according to the market value. They're exactly the same. Echad emocher vechad alkech eish lehem ona. V'chol mishnes ana mihen yochol achol erbo. So whichever person was cheated can nullify the transaction. So if I sell my phone to Mr. Hirsch for $10, so I can go to the Bezdin and say, whoops, you know, I realize that there's not this going rate, so I want my phone back from Mrs. Hirsch, and then the Bezdin will force Mrs. Hirsch to give me back my phone, and I will give her back her $10. Okay? That the percentage of the transaction that must be, in other words, for the sale to still be valid, but I have to give back the difference in price that was incorrect, is a sixth. So if it's Oshtus Hadomim. So there are two ways. Either it's less than a sixth, either it's a sixth of the value of the object, or a sixth of the amount of money that was paid. So if either condition was fulfilled, if it was a sixth, if it was overcharged or underpaid by a sixth, then the transaction is not nullified. We don't have a recourse to completely undo it to get my phone back, but rather the person who overpaid or undercharged would have to pay back the sixth of the transaction that was overpaid or underpaid. Bashir ha'ona she'ein machzir in afilo osa ein tzorach lomar she'ein mevad l'nemekach b'shvila hu pachos mishtus ha'mekach ve'adomim. If it's less than a sixth, then too bad. Less than a sixth, the was overcharged, underpaid. It's a done deal. Sorry, nothing doing, nothing going back.
What makes him decide
the sixth? The Chachamim just said they assessed that was the normal amount that people were willing to forego.
Where?
That time. They established this principle formally.
Is that a number that comes up in other? I was trying to think, is that some standard?
No. It's just the Torah says that you're not allowed to do onah. So the Chachamim affixed that this is the way that it works. Whether it's the price or the amount of money that was paid. So here's there are three chilukim over here. Less than a sixth, nothing doing, transaction, money, everything stays put. If it's exactly a sixth, the money returns, the overpayment or underpayment returns what? Is rectified. Exactly, rectified. That's a good word. And if it's over a sixth, then the entire transaction is nullified. Okay? Those are the three chilukim over here. If it's more than a sixth and the transaction is nullified, so even if they're not even still at the store, because the buyer went home with the object and the seller went home with the money, everything, you know, it's people view it as a done deal. Nevertheless, the transaction could be nullified if the people realize that there was an no over here. Davka sheba lachzor bo misha misane, misha nisane. So this only applies if the complainer was the one who was cheated. Ava bo lachzor bo hameane machmas shizakra peros bintayim o betayna acheres ein shomin lo. So just imagine, if it worked either way, you could have as follows. So a buyer, so at the store, the store owner sold an object for a very high price. Let's say it was really worth $10, and he sold it to this hapless customer for $30. Okay, so that's it's more than a six. So that's that the transaction would be nullified. So the purchaser paid $30 for this radio. Okay, paid $30 for this radio, even though it was only worth $10. So then they go home. Everyone's happy, And then, and looking online that night, the store owner realizes that this type of radio, the fair price earlier that day was $10. So at the time, $30 was way overcharging. But the next day, the store owner hears that this type of radio now sells for $200. Now sells for $200.
Tough on you, buddy.
So the store owner, in this scenario that Sefer Chinuch rejects, the store owner could now go to Beis Din and say, hey, I overcharged him for the radio. It was only worth 10 at the time, and I charged him 30. Give it back to me. Because now I want to sell it for the going rate now, which is $300. So obviously such a situation is completely untenable, which is why the only person who can have a claim of onah to cancel the sale is the person who was cheated, and not the person who did the cheating. Because that's called what we call in halacha, chote niskar, somebody who wins for sinning. Okay.
Well, sorry, it's not, let's say that you pay for stock, let's say, okay? So you pay, you know, right. So you pay $100 a share, right?
Yeah.
And really the going rate was like was like $50.
Yeah.
Next day it goes down to $10.
Right.
Now you have reason to say, hey, I want my money back, you know, I want to be reversed so that, you don't lose more than,
But you could do that.
Hmm? You're allowed to do that, though.
Yeah, so, right. If you were the victim, right,
in other words,
but it doesn't matter. It goes by the time of the sale.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. By the time
If you realize that that you overpaid, and then the price goes down the next day, so that you realize you overpaid even more, and you're going to lose even more money, then you can nullify the sale because you overpaid at the time of the sale. Exactly.
But what does overpaid mean? Stock is like, it's like gambling. I mean,
stock is the easy case here because there's a market price.
Right, there's an exact market price.
Right,
exactly.
Price, right. So,
but
you know,
it changes all the time.
But it doesn't matter. It goes by the time of the sale.
The time of sale. That instant.
Mm-hmm. So fine. Bechenu. So it can't be that, what do you mean? If you didn't cheat me, you couldn't have gone back with a sale. Now that you cheated me, you can get this thing back. That makes no sense. V'cheinu alashin b'gimara. V'rav chistu d'amr l'shmaita. Rav chistu said this. Klomer d'amr l'emishin is'ana l'ma'ana b'shas ha'mecher. Ha'revach ye'imach u'chvar niskayim imkareinu o mekcheinu machamasach. But if you say at the time of the sale, he says, so here I'm giving you extra, I'm paying you extra. It's fine. If you say it explicitly at the time of the sale that, you know, I'm selling this to you, and I'm charging you this price, and it doesn't matter what the going rate is. This is the price that we are agreeing upon. And the buyer says, yes, I agree. And the seller says, yes, I agree. So in such a case, there's no onad. Nobody has a claim on each other. The Chazal didn't tell you this is an absolute rule that doesn't depend on the wishes of the parties. It's for the benefit of the person who's being cheated. So again, if the items were found to be not the correct items, which is a similar case to Onah, so again, it depends on what the original deal was and what the item that was actually delivered to the buyer was. If it was in the negative interest of the buyer, then the buyer can declare that the sale should be nullified. If it was a negative interest of the seller, so the seller can declare that the sale should be nullified. The sages tell us, so can you imagine that this could go on forever? That if, in the case of where somebody paid $30 for a $10 radio, so 10 years later, the person wakes up, looks at, radio prices from 10 years ago in their spare time because he's bored. Oh my gosh.
That's
I completely overpaid for this radio 10 years ago. And maybe, inflation, you know, maybe the whole money, the whole thing is completely different now, so it doesn't make sense to return it. So could you imagine that he could go back to the store and say, hey, here's my receipt from 10 years ago, I overpaid, here's the proof, I want my money back, and here's your radio. No, there's a limited amount of time that you have to lodge a complaint of ona'ah. It's different for different things. That it's not the same by the purchaser and the seller. It's different. So let's say you're making a transaction of different types of coins. So the amount of time is that the purchaser should be able to show the coin to the local money changer to determine if it's a really good coin or not, or what's the correct value. So if he's living in a small town that doesn't have its own money changer, so you have to give him the amount of time that he should go to on the market day to the larger city and show the coin to the money changer and figure out what's going on. Now basically, he's expected to tend to this as soon as possible, mm-hmm. not to leave it months or years later, so then that would just be crazy. Everything else in the difference between a small town and a large city. So let's say you purchase a diamond. So all Jews have relatives in the diamond business, right? So you go to, go take the diamond. You're told by the seller, oh, this is a really great diamond. I'm really giving you a really good price on it. So you buy the diamond. Then you go to your cousin who's also in the diamond business. And you show him the diamond, and you figure out if the price that you paid was really a fair price. So any case that comes before a Beis Din that's potentially subject to the rules of Ona'ah, so they have to figure out as to what would be a reasonable amount of time to have the purchaser assess the correctness and fairness of the purchase. The Chazal couldn't possibly have listed an exact time measure for each item that could possibly be sold to give you a window to lodge a complaint of Ona'ah, but rather the Dayanim in each individual case have to figure out what would be appropriate for this person. So if you buy a diamond, so how long does it take to get to 47th Street? You might only have a matter of a couple of hours if you purchase a diamond in New York. The Rava Nosan Tam Bagimara Bechilo Kamad Bea Mishar Skores Damer Derechal Talis the Chol Inish Kimle Sela Leshulchan Yehuda Kimle. But if it's an object that everybody knows basically what's the going rate, so it says Rava says in the Gemara everybody knows the price of a garment, a basic garment, but they don't necessarily know the correct price of a fancy coin. So you're going to give more time to make sure that the purchaser knows what's going on with the coin rather than somebody who just bought a cloak, which is something they should be able to figure out basically by themselves what the correct price is. Avar zehoeis velo chazer bo halokeach. If this amount of time passed and the purchaser did not lodge a complaint of Ona'ah, I feel yesh bo Ona'ah yoser mi shtus kama, even if he overpaid by tenfold, way more than a sixth. Ein yochol lachzer bo min adin. That the halacha is that that he cannot now lodge a complaint of Ona'ah and have the purchase be nullified. Well, Amru Chachamim, Shemimidas Chasidus Roy Lachazira La'olam. That it's nevertheless proper religious practice for the purchaser, I'm sorry, for the seller to agree to nullify the transaction without any time limit. That the time limit is what's for the strict halacha, but nevertheless, it's a pious practice for the seller to agree to nullify the transaction, even if the window has elapsed.
It's a preferred practice, right? I mean,
it's not at all obligatory,
mm-hmm. right? But it's the preferred thing to do. It's necessary to do. You said something about religious practice, but this is a preferred. Midas Chasidus means.
You have to do it.
It's explained,
right. Right.
It's explained why the Chofetz Chaim went out of business and he tried to run a store, right?
That's right. Is there a difference between Lifted Mishra's Hadin and Midas Chasidus?
Lifnim Mishuras Hadin, I mean, it's similar concepts, uh-huh. You're right. But Lifnim Mishuras Hadin is, I would say, more obligatory. Not either one is absolutely obligatory. Uh-huh. But Lifnim Mishuras Hadin is like, you really should. You really should do that. And Midas Chasidus means that if you're a very pious person, so this is an appropriate practice for you.
That's Chomers.
Yeah.
Well, no. Chomer means if there are, you know, if there's a minority opinion, there was, or, you know.
Well, there are two different types of chomers. Okay. There's the famous, like the Briskerov said about drinking water outside the sukkah on sukkah. So the Gemara says that it's a chumrah. There's a chumrah, an extra pious practice to refrain from drinking, eating, or drinking anything outside of the sukkah on sukkah, even water. The Briskerov was known as being very stringent, you know, was once observed drinking water outside the sukkah and sukkah, so they asked him, Briskerov, what do you mean? You're so frum, this is, you're drinking water outside the sukkah? He says, Ich bin nicht kein Machmer. I'm not a Machmer, meaning,
only in his own
what he meant was that things that are for sure not halachically required, he didn't exert his energy for those things. He only exerted his energy for things which may be halachically required, even if there's a minority opinion that it's halachically required. So there, he was willing to exert energy to try to fulfill those things. But he used his religious energy only in that way, and not for the things that are pure chumris, which are things that everybody agrees are not required for you to do by halacha at all, but rather, there's the other type of chumra, which Charlie just mentioned, which is that sometimes in halacha, when there is a minority opinion, the majority opinion, the normative practice is a certain way, but there's a minority opinion, so then it's considered to be a pious thing to be machmir, to be stringent, and conduct oneself also in accordance with the minority opinion.
How is that different from what the Briskerov didn't do?
That's what the Briskerov did. What the Briskerov didn't do are things that everybody agrees are not at all halachically required. They're an optional, voluntary, extra pious practice. So those he didn't do.
Just optional, voluntary, extra pious practice. Okay.
So, let's think of something. So,
taking the chicken around the block to make sure it's
chumrah. Oh, maybe that's not a chumrah. Maybe that's required nowadays with the chickens being as sick as they are. Just to take a minority shita. So, by salting meat. So I don't know if the Briskerov was makbid on this or not. I don't think he was, but I'm not 100% sure. So there's an opinion that we know our normative opinion about salting meat is that you can salt the piece of meat any as large as you want. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you finish the salting, it's kosher. There's nothing more to be done with it. You can cut it up into as many pieces as you want, and all the pieces will consider to be kosher. But there is an opinion. The Rambam might hold like this. The Gaonim held like this, the Ra'ah, I believe, held like this. There are a few Rishonim that hold that every time you make a new cut in the meat, you have to salt that surface. So in other words, if you...
plate? I mean,
No, before you cook it, before you cook it, before you cook it. So according to this opinion...
Hamburgers also?
No, after you cook it, everybody agrees you're allowed. So according to this minority opinion, if you purchase... I mean, let's say you purchase the whole chicken... Your whole chicken's been salted whole.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you can either cook it, and then you can, after you cook it, so it's fine, and you can cut it as much as you want. But if you want to butcher it before the cooking, you want to cut it into, quarters or eighths or whatever, so you would have to re-salt the surface of the meat.
The cut surface.
That's the cut surface of the meat that didn't have the salt actually touch it.
So and hamburgers have to be broiled, period.
Exactly. So according to his opinion, you cannot have ground meat, basically.
Well,
you cannot cook ground meat.
But we do have ground meat.
Correct. Again, you can't possibly. We don't hold like this. I'm saying we hold our the sheet, the normative halachic sheet is, as soon as you salt a piece of meat, no matter how large, that's it. You're allowed to cut it after that. You don't have to resalt it. Okay. So I'm saying, so according to that sheet, right. So hamburger is, you can't have meatballs.
What?
You cannot have meatballs, according to this opinion.
You could treat it like liver.
You could flame
right,
oil.
I'm saying you that's could broil a hamburger on a grill,
right.
But that's you could not, because broiling also takes out the blood, but you cannot cook it, which requires salting, because you can't get salt on all the cut surfaces of ground meat. It's impossible. They're tiny, tiny little pieces. We don't hold that way. We don't hold it that way. We can have meatballs. But I'm saying that would be an example of a the other type of chumrah, not an optional pious practice, but rather, if you wanted to be concerned for this, that would be a chumrah of the type that there is a minority opinion that this is absolutely halachically required, and therefore, out of concern for the minority opinion, I want to fulfill this.
The fact that chicken is not considered by all sages to be meat.
No, that's not. First, right, but that only affects the issue of cooking with milk. That doesn't affect this issue of the salting. Everybody agrees that you have to salt chicken.
Yeah, but the other category would be shita dechuya, which is something which is so thoroughly, you know, discredited, shall we say, that you're not allowed to pay any attention whatsoever.
So it's a question, at what point in history do you say that something is completely rejected? So we generally assume that if something is explicit in the Mishnah or the Gemara, that the shita was rejected, either because there was an official vote on it in the Sanhedrin, which we don't have anymore. So that's why there's more of a weight to minority opinions. But even in later cases, if something is so completely rejected that, you know, it's a mamish, a one opinion in the Rishonim that no one was ever concerned for, then we would, again, I can't tell you what every brisker would say, but we would normally assume that there would not even be a midas chasidus, a pious practice, to conduct oneself stringently in accordance with the minority opinion. This, and then the Mesilas Yesharim, when he talks about this idea of chumris, of concerning oneself for minority opinions, so he says that, again, not obligatory. The way halacha works, that's obligatory. You have to follow the normative, you know, majority opinions that your rabbis say you have to follow. But it is a pious practice to go in accordance with the minority opinion if, he says, im tamo nire, if it makes sense. If something's been thoroughly rejected, or you absolutely can't understand what this rabbi was talking about, even if it was a very great rabbi, then there's not even a midas chasidus to conduct oneself. Again, you have to figure out what makes sense for you.
It's subjective, though.
Right, it's subjective. If you're someone who's on the fence, that, you know, you're struggling with the basic halacha, then it doesn't make sense for you to take on extra things. But if you're in a place in your relationship with God that you want to, again, not that you're shaking, the correct attitude is not that if you don't follow the minority opinions, if you just limit yourself to the basic halacha, you shouldn't be, you know, shaking in your boots that you're going to hell. That's not the correct Jewish perspective on these things. But it should be that you want to demonstrate to God that you're so concerned and so serious about observing His Torah properly that if there's a minority opinion, that that makes sense. So you want, out of seriousness and love for God, you want to take it on. Yeah.
But aren't there opinions which have been so thoroughly rejected that to follow them is usher?
That, again, that would apply more to the ones that are explicitly rejected in the Talmud. I would say usually, sometimes you might find something like that within the Rishonim and Achronim, but to say it's usher to follow them is, we don't follow Beis Shammai, right?
Well,
can you think of an example? What example are you thinking of?
No more examples.
I was wondering if you had something in mind when you're asking this question. A shita in the Rishonim that's so thoroughly. Again, in the later time, after the Chasimus HaTalmud, it's hard to find something where the poskim say, you know, you absolutely are not allowed to do this. They say, no, you don't have to do this, you don't even have to volunteer this, you know, even if you're super, 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 super pious, but to say it's usser, again, I can't, it's possible that there's an example like that.
If your religious state of mind, relationship with God and all that, is such that this is going to work for you, fine, but don't go around imposing it on other people.
Oh, that's terrible. Yes, of course. Everybody has to realize that it's a personal thing about your relationship with God as opposed to something that should be, of course.
You want to fast Monday and Thursday, fine, just don't talk about it.
Right.
If you publicly observe some bizarre, you know, chumrah, as it were, then you are, in fact, if people pay attention to you, this is almost imposing whether you say explicitly or not.
Correct. Yes. Especially religious leaders have to be very careful about what things they do, especially in public, because people are going to copy them.
Like, don't tell people I don't eat turkey, that sort of thing, right?
Okay.
Well, he thinks that's not a chumrah.
Oh.
Okay.
Very words, the meaning of the words, lefi mishura sadin, that would be something which I suppose would be applicable to clear guidelines that are written or agreed upon by rabbinic convention as opposed to Hasidus, which are ways of behavior, a minhag.
Well, listen to me, sure, then there are certain examples that are given in Chazal of things in monetary transactions, especially that it would be considered lifnim mishura sadin and are explicitly recommended. That is certainly true. But in terms of pious practices, you know, everything is in books nowadays. You can look as to where the minority opinions are and what's normal to.
Is the fact that they are written, therefore, something which makes that to become more stringent and to have more of a quality of lefi mishura sadin me, because it is written.
There's still a minhag, though, as opposed to din. I mean, there's still a distinction, you know, which most of us observe between right. a minhag and a actual din.
Yeah. And what is the delineation about whether something is a minhag or not a minhag?
Oof, that's really
tough question.
It's a very tough question. Yeah.
Again, because very subjective in many respects and depends on the interpretation.
Yeah,
of
a minhag is it just because you know I'm fond of saying that just because your father stood on his head after Havdalah every Motzei Shabbos doesn't mean you have to, that's your minhag, and you have to stand on your head after Havdalah every Motzei Shabbos. A minhag is something that to a certain extent, your family, that is recommended that all things being equal, you should not jettison things that were observed in your family.
Like,
but especially community local minhagim is even more binding in halakha than ancestral family minhagim. Which means that the minhag is something that was adopted by the community as a specific religious observance with the guidance of the religious authorities of the community.
The stringency of the binding nature of that is how stringent.
Well, let's say Gebrot, which is something that people take very seriously, but it's recognized, in fact, you know, that like Eighth Day of Pesach, Hasidim eat Gebrot.
Yeah, they eat Gebrot because
they want to show, in fact, they understand that it's a minhag, not a din.
They said, we Hasidim are the real Jews, but we have Rachmanas on the not real Jews, you know, the Misnagdim. So, you know, we don't want them to feel that we don't want, if we kept Gebrot all the 8 days of Pesach, so then God will look at say, oh, my real Jews are really serious about Gebrot, so I have to treat that as a real halacha. So those, you know, non-Chassidic Jews who are eating Gebrot the whole Pesach are going to be punished for it. So the Chassidim, out of their, you know, are their rachmanas and their mercy on us, they eat Gebrot on the 8th day of Pesach, so that God will look and say, oh, Gebrot can't be that serious if even my Chassidim are eating Gebrot. I'm paraphrasing. I'm being a little farcical, but it's somewhat like that. No, so they say, oh, so you know, so on the 8th day, so it can't be that serious, so I won't take it out on the rest of the Jews who aren't quite as good. So, okay, that's not...
just acknowledging that it's...
I'm being facetious, but it's something like that. They want to... Yeah, that's why also it's Ramosha Sternbuch writes that he heard from a Chassidish Rebbe that he thinks that, that he personally, he doesn't rely on Mechiras Chametz. Mm-hmm. He doesn't sell any Chametz on Pesach because of all the questions about the efficacy of that. But after there are certain people who are stringent, again, very, very uncommon nowadays, but there are certain people who are stringent that they don't even rely on regarding eating after Pesach chametz that was sold. Because they so don't hold of the mechira that they consider chametz shavar all of HaPesach. There are many reasons why that's probably not...
Until when?
What?
Until when?
Until they're confident that it wasn't sold. Okay, but so this Chassidish Rebbe said that he specifically does buy sold chametz after Pesach. To show God... You know, this is my stringency. I feel that there's a chashash deraisa, whatever, I should be machmir, not to rely on the mechiras chametz. But God, your Jews who rely on mechiras chametz, even during Pesach, regarding their chametz that they have in their house, they're also good. And I want them to show that since I bedavka go out of my way to buy it after Pesach, to rely on it after Pesach, and I don't consider it so far that it's chametz shavah Pesach. So I'm displaying that really I believe that they're good too. They didn't sin.
Right.
It's just my stringency that I feel is more appropriate.
As a community leader, that's really important thing to be doing.
That's one approach.
Yeah.
The Chazon Ish. Okay, I'll get back to the Chazon Ish as well. Just about this. So the Chazon Ish famously said that he didn't write it down anywhere, but it's in the name of the Chazon Ish, that it doesn't make sense to consider a chametz that was sold, chametz shavalav Pesach, even if you hold that mechiras chametz doesn't work, because the chametz shavalav Pesach, you're not allowed to buy chametz after Pesach, or chametz that was owned by a Jew during Pesach, is because the Chazal imposed a knas, a penalty. So he says, what do you mean? How is it charged to impose a penalty? These people who sold chametz during Pesach, even if it's totally wrong, even if Alpi Halacha doesn't work, they went to their rabbi, they did the right thing, they did the right with their rabbi, they said, Rabbi, sell my chametz, am I allowed to sell my chametz? The rabbi said, yes, you're allowed to sell your chametz. They did the right thing. They listened to their rabbi, so how can you impose a knas? This is a very interesting svara. Very interesting svara. Okay. Okay, but there is a minority of people who would say if they don't rely on Mechiritz Chametz during Pesach, they don't rely on it for after Pesach either.
Does the Chazon Ish hold that as a generalization, that it's up to the person you ask the Shiloh?
No, because this is only because this is a knas.
Yeah.
Okay. It only makes sense if you did something wrong that you shouldn't have done, that you could be expected not to do. Right.
And that's not in that claim.
Right. Okay, the final type of chumrah, before we back to Akzei Rechon, just to round the discussion, is not that you're concerned for minority opinion and not that you adopt an independent pious practice that's not recorded in halacha, but rather sometimes, you know, somebody who learns the sugya very well, it's a Talmid Chacham, and he learns the sugya very well, he will come to a conclusion that is more stringent than the prevailing practice. So he doesn't impose it on others because he realizes it's his new understanding of the sugya. But since he worked on it very hard, he got very attached to the sugya and learned it up very well, so he wants to fulfill his understanding of the sugya, which is a little bit more stringent. That's why sometimes you have differences even within one household between the husband and the wife. Because in most households, not all, but in most households, the husband knows how to study Torah better than the wife. So sometimes he'll learn through a sugya and he'll say, oh, I want to be stringent regarding thing X. And the wife says, you didn't learn the sugya. You know, you can just do like everyone else. You don't have to be stringent in this regard.
So then what happens?
So then he's machmer. Obviously, it can't be something that affects both of them.
Right.
Can't be something in Hilchos Nida or Kashrus or something that would affect the whole house.
Right.
Obviously, that obviously wouldn't work.
You just have two separate things.
Mm-hmm. Right, okay. Chol Yisrael, if the wife wants the...
Chol Yisrael milk.
Right, fine. But I'm talking about the dishes, or if there's something
or
that would,
turkey.
You know...
Some of the people in your house eat the turkey.
Right, but that's if you hold that it doesn't affect the dishes. Okay, but if you hold that, if it's something that would affect the dishes, then obviously that wouldn't work.
Who grew up, very fluent people, but they grew up not with Chol Yisrael.
Yeah.
Married into Chol Yisrael, and I said, well, don't you, like, can't you have Baskin Robbins outside the house by yourself?
Mm.
I don't know what a position is on that.
So women who are marrying into a family where or the husband or the family is more stringent, so they have to figure out before the wedding what they're going to do. Some couples are totally comfortable where the husband does his own thing and the wife does her own thing, as long as it doesn't, again, affect the relationship or the house or whatever. They can do completely, they can observe halacha completely differently. Doesn't affect anything, except maybe the kids will be confused, but they'll figure out how to deal with that. Others say, the husband will say, well, if I have what I consider a chumrah, then I'll do it and you don't have to do it. But things that I hold, maker adin. Things that if I'm a Talmud Chacham and I hold that this is absolutely the correct halachic practice, then even if it's not the normative practice, so this I do want you to do, but things I accept as astringently, I don't care if you do or not. And the third approach is that the husband and wife want to do exactly the same thing. They want to observe Judaism exactly the same way. So the three different approaches in terms of families. Everybody has to figure out.
BT started out with 6 hours. I married a 3-hour guy. Isn't that cool?
Okay. Yeah.
Regarding the salting process, I remember when my mother would do a chicken and salt it. And are there guidelines about the length of time that the salt needs to be applied? Because she would do it for a rather long time.
Mm-hmm.
But are there guidelines about that as well?
The minimum is 18 to 24 minutes, but the custom is to leave it in the salt for 1 hour. Doesn't have to be more than an hour for sure. But if it was salted for less than an hour, it's still perfectly kosher to be eaten as long as it was more than 18 to 24 minutes, different shittas.
Interesting. How effective would the salt be on the chicken that still has all the skin?
Wait, let's.
Okay. Yeah.
It works. The salting works.
Okay.
Don't get any ideas. I'm not saying you should be machmir on the. Salting with not eating ground meat, you know?
The principle is that you're supposed to take away all blood that can move by its,
it's
movable.
Right.
If the blood basically is way inside the chicken, then it's not movable, and so therefore it's kosher. You know, that's right.
V'shiurin elu hein belokeach. So these windows of time to complain about onah are referring to the buyer. Aval hamocher chozer bo le'olam. Because the seller cannot be expected. He doesn't have this merchandise anymore. So he sold it already, so he can't take it to his cousin on 47th Street to assess if he really sold it for the correct price. But if the mocher was underpaid, so he can go, he can cancel the sale forever. It's not in his hands anymore, so he can't discuss it, and he can't show it around. By the way, not everybody agrees about this pious practice thing. The Rashi does that hold that you don't have to. There's no requirement to give the onah back after the window. Below Nemru dinim elu shekasav ne'ele belokeach mina tagar. So these rules are only if you're purchasing from a merchant. Velokeach mi bal habayis ein bo onah. Below bitul mekach besoch hazman akotzov she'amarnu. Below Achergan, there's no onah when you buy from a private individual. Shelo Nemru Elo Advarim Ela Batagorim Latikun Olin Liyishuv Amedinos. This only refers to merchants because we want to make it that the marketplace functions properly. Balabatim Ein Mochrim Klam Ela Biyoker. Everybody knows that individuals charge a lot of money for their objects. Uvnei Adam Bedaiton Inyan Zeshu Bahen. They will always forgive the onah by a balabayas. Meaning, you go into someone's house and you say, you look at the wall and you say, oh my gosh, that's a gorgeous picture. How much will you sell it to me for? I'm not selling it to you. It's decorating my wall. You don't walk into someone's house and you ask to buy a picture.
Watch
that. Right, you don't ask to buy a picture that's on the wall. What are you talking about? I'll give you $50,000. Okay, it's yours. So if the price is right, so even a private individual is going to part with their own things or their favorite pot in the kitchen. Someone walks in the kitchen. What do you mean, this pot you could buy in a store for $20? No, I really want this pot. I want your pot. I don't have time to go to the store. I want your pot. I'm not a merchant. What do you mean? What do you want from me? I'll give it to you for $200. Okay, I'll buy the pot for $200. So if you buy from a private individual, again, the private individual also a diamond merchant, you know, just because you went to their house and you you looked at their collection of diamonds there.
My wife's diamond ring.
Yeah, that would be bal habayis. But if the if the person, it has to do with whether this interaction is in the manner of a merchant or in the manner of private individuals. That's the Sefer Chinuch Shita, that even if it was sold for twice the value, then it does not count as onah. So these things. It's forbidden to charge or overcharge or underpay. That's the Ramban Shita. We pointed out there are those who disagree. Hakarkos v'ha'avodim shehukshu l'karkos. Land and slaves. Find that land and slaves are always the same. Kemosha nilmad v'gemara midichsi visnach al temos. That says that slaves you shall give as a nachala, as an inheritance. So nachala is the word that's more commonly used for land. So therefore, we know that slaves and land have similar halachos. V'ashtaros v'ha'hekdeshos. Also, onah does not apply if you sell documents, in other words, the debt that's included in the document, and things that you give to the Beis HaMikdash, or that the Beis HaMikdash sells. Kemo she'amru zichron al-lebracha, tan rabbanu mikisim karu mimkar o kano miyad, tavra nikna miyad liyad, zotzu akarko she'enu metalten. So included, since it says o kano miyad, that the official rules of onah only apply by things that you are transferred from hand to hand. So that obviously doesn't apply to land, and slaves are like land. mimkar, things that are sold. Misha gufo kanui, has to be something that's intrinsically sold in itself. Yatsu elu she'en gufan kanui, elu l'raya sheben. So the document itself, nobody cares about buying and selling the actual document. Mm-hmm. The point is the debt that's described in the document. So therefore, there's no ona'a over here.
I came late today,